Carmilla by J. Sheridan LeFanu. Prologue. Upon a paper attached to the narrative which follows, Dr. Hesselius has written a rather elaborate note, which he accompanies with a reference to his essay on the strange subject which the manuscript illuminates. This mysterious subject he treats in that essay with his usual learning and acumen, and with remarkable directness and condensation. It will form but one volume of the series of that extraordinary man's collected papers. As I publish the case in this volume simply to interest the laity, I shall forestall the intelligent lady who relates it in nothing, and after due consideration, I have determined therefore to abstain from presenting any précis of the learned doctor's reasoning, or extract from his statement on the subject which he describes as involving, not improbably, some of the profoundest arcana of our dual existence and its intermediates. I was anxious on discovering this paper to reopen the correspondence commenced by Dr. Hesselius, so many years before with a person so clever and careful as his informant seems to have been. Much to my regret, however, I found that she had died in the interval. She probably could have added little to the narrative which she communicates in the following pages, with, so far as I can pronounce, such conscientiousness particularity. 1. An early fright. In Styria we, though by no means magnificent people, inhabit a castle, or schloss. A small income in that part of the world goes a great way. 800 or 900 a year does wonders. Scantily enough ours would have answered among wealthy people at home. My father is English, and I bear an English name, although I never saw England. But here, in this lonely and primitive place, where everything is so marvellously cheap, I really don't see how ever so much more money would at all materially add to our comforts or even luxuries. My father was in the Austrian service, and retired upon a pension and his patrimony, and purchased his feudal residence and the small estate on which it stands, a bargain. Nothing can be more picturesque or solitary. It stands on a slight eminence in a forest. The road, very old and narrow, passes in front of its drawbridge, never raised in my time, and its moat, stocked with perch, and sailed over by many swans, and floating on its surface white fleets of water lilies. Of all of this, the schloss shows its many-windowed front, its towers, and its Gothic chapel. The forest opens in an irregular and very picturesque glade before its gate, and at the right a steep Gothic bridge carries the road over a stream that winds in deep shadow through the wood. I have said that this is a very lonely place. Judge whether I say truth. Looking from the hall towards the road, the forest in which our castle stands extends 15 miles to the right and 12 to the left. The nearest inhabited valley is about 7 of your English miles to the left. The nearest inhabited schloss of any historic associations is that of old General Spielsdorf, nearly 20 miles away to the right. I have said the nearest inhabited village, because there is, only 3 miles westward, that is to say in the direction of General Spieldorf's schloss, a ruined village, with its quaint little church now roofless, in the aisle of which are the mouldering tombs of the proud family of Karnstein, now extinct, who once owned the equally desolate chateau which, in the thick of the forest, overlooks the silent ruins of the town. Respecting the cause of the desertion of this striking and melancholy spot, there is a legend which I shall relate to you another time. I must tell you now how very small is the party who constitute the inhabitants of our castle. I don't include servants or those dependents who occupy rooms in buildings attached to the schloss. Listen and wonder. My father, who is the kindest man on earth, but growing old, and I, at the date of my story, only 19. 8 years have passed since then. I and my father constituted the family at the schloss. My mother, a Styrian lady, died in my infancy. But I had a good-natured governess who had been with me from, I might almost say, my infancy. I could not remember the time when her fat, benign face was not a familiar picture in my memory. This was Madame Perrodon, a native of Bern, whose care and good nature now in part supplied to me the loss of my mother, whom I do not even remember, so early I lost her. She made a third at our little dinner party. There was a fourth, Mademoiselle de la Fontaine, a lady such as you term, I believe, a finishing governess. She spoke French and German, Madame Perrodon French and broken English, to which my father and I added English, which partly to prevent its becoming a lost language among us, and partly from patriotic motives, We spoke every day. The consequence was a babble at which strangers used to laugh, and which I shall make no attempt to reproduce in this narrative. And there were two or three young lady friends besides, pretty nearly of my own age, who were occasional visitors for longer or shorter terms, and these visits I sometimes returned. These were our regular social resources, but of course there were chance visits from neighbours of only 5 or 6 leagues distance. My life was, notwithstanding, rather a solitary one, I can assure you. My gouvernante had just so much control over me as you might conjecture such sage persons would have in the case of a rather spoiled girl whose only parent allowed her pretty nearly her own way in everything. The first occurrence in my existence which produced a terrible impression upon my mind, which, in fact, never has been effaced, was one of the very earliest incidents of my life which I can recollect. Some people will think it so trifling that it should not be recorded here. You will see, however, by and by, why I mention it. The nursery, as it was called, though I had it all to myself, was a large room in the upper story of the castle, with a steep oak roof. I can't have been more than 6 years old when one night I awoke, and looking round the room from my bed, failed to see the nursery maid. Neither was my nurse there, and I thought myself alone. I was not frightened, for I was one of those happy children who are studiously kept in ignorance of ghost stories, of fairy tales, and of all such lore as makes us cover up our heads when the door cracks suddenly, or the flicker of an expiring candle makes the shadow of a bedpost dance upon the wall, nearer to our faces. I was vexed and insulted at finding myself, as I conceived, neglected, and I began to whimper, preparatory to a hearty bout of roaring, when to my surprise, I saw a solemn but very pretty face looking at me from the side of the bed. It was that of a young lady who was kneeling with her hands under the coverlet. I looked at her with a kind of pleased wonder and ceased whimpering. She caressed me with her hands and lay down beside me on the bed and drew me towards her, smiling. I felt immediately delightfully soothed and fell asleep again. I was wakened by a sensation as if two needles ran into my breast very deep at the same moment, and I cried loudly. The lady started back with her eyes fixed on me, and then slipped down upon the floor, and as I thought, hid herself under the bed. I was now for the first time frightened, and I yelled with all my might and main. Nurse, nursery maid, housekeeper, all came running in, and hearing my story, they made light of it, soothing me all they could meanwhile. But, child as I was, I could perceive that their faces were pale with an unwonted look of anxiety, and I saw them look under the bed and about the room and peep under tables and pluck open cupboards, and the housekeeper whispered to the nurse, "Lay your hand along that hollow in the bed. Someone did lie there, so sure as you did not. The place is still warm." I remember the nursery maid petting me, and all three examining my chest where I told them I felt the puncture, and pronouncing that there was no sign visible that any such thing had happened to me. The housekeeper and the two other servants who were in charge of the nursery remained sitting up all night, and from that time a servant always sat up in the nursery until I was about 14. I was very nervous for a long time after this. A doctor was called in. He was pallid and elderly. How well I remember his long saturnine face, slightly pitted with smallpox, and his chestnut wig. For a good while, every second day, he came and gave me medicine, which of course I hated. The morning after I saw this apparition, I was in a state of terror and could not bear to be left alone, daylight though it was, for a moment. I remember my father coming in and standing at the bedside and talking cheerfully and asking the nurse a number of questions and laughing very heartily at one of the answers and patting me on the shoulder and kissing me and telling me not to be frightened, that it was nothing but a dream and could not hurt me. But I was not comforted, for I knew the visit of the strange woman was not a dream, and I was awfully frightened. I was a little consoled by the nursery maid assuring me that it was she who had come and looked at me and lain down beside me, and that I must have been half dreaming not to have known her face. But this, though supported by the nurse, did not quite satisfy me. I remembered in the course of that day a venerable old man in a black cassock coming into the room with the nurse and the housekeeper and talking a little to them and very kindly to me. His face was very sweet and gentle, and he told me they were going to pray and joined my hands together, and decided me to say softly while they were praying, "Lord, hear all good prayers for us, for Jesus' sake." I think these were the words, for I often repeated them to myself, and my nurse used to for years to make me say them in my prayers. I remembered so well the thoughtful, sweet face of that white-haired old man in his black cassock as he stood in the rude, lofty brown room with the clumsy furniture of a fashion 300 years old about him, and the scanty light entering its shadowy atmosphere through the small lattice. He kneeled, and the three women with him, and he prayed aloud with an earnest, quavering voice for what appeared to me a long time. I forget all my life preceding that event, and for some time after it is all obscure also, but the scenes I have just described stand out vivid as the isolated pictures of the phantasmagoria surrounded by darkness. 2. A guest. I am now going to tell you something so strange that it will require all your faith in my veracity to believe my story. It is not only true, nevertheless, but truth of which I have been an eyewitness. It was a sweet summer evening, and my father asked me, as he sometimes did, to take a little ramble with him along that beautiful forest vista which I have mentioned as lying in front of the Schloss. "General Spielsdorf cannot come to us so soon as I had hoped," said my father, as we pursued the walk. He was to have paid us a visit of some weeks, and we had expected his arrival the next day. He was to have brought with him a young lady, his niece and ward, Mademoiselle Reinfeldt, whom I had never seen, but whom I had heard described as a very charming girl, and in whose society I had promised myself many happy days. I was more disappointed than a young lady living in a town or a bustling neighbourhood can possibly imagine. This visit, and the new acquaintance it promised, had furnished my daydream for many weeks. "And how soon does he come?" I asked. "Not till autumn, not for 2 months, I dare say," he answered. "And I'm very glad now, dear, that you never knew Mademoiselle Reinfeldt." "And why?" I asked, both mortified and curious. "Because the poor young lady is dead," he replied. "I quite forgot I had not told you, but you were not in the room when I received the general's letter this evening." I was very much shocked. General Spielsdorf had mentioned in his first letter 6 or 7 weeks before that she was not so well as he would wish her, but there was nothing to suggest the remotest suspicion of danger. "Here's the general's letter," he said, handing it to me. "I'm afraid he is in great affliction. The letter appears to me to have been written very nearly in distraction." We sat down on a rude bench under a group of magnificent lime trees. The sun was setting with all its melancholy splendor behind the sylvan horizon, and the stream that flows beside our home and passes under the steep old bridge I have mentioned wound through many a group of noble trees almost at our feet, reflecting in its current the fading crimson of the sky. General Spieldorf's letter was so extraordinary, so vehement, and in some places so self-contradictory, that I read it twice over, the second time aloud to my father, and was still unable to account for it, except by supposing that grief had unsettled his mind. It said, "I have lost my darling daughter, for as such I loved her. During the last days of dear Bertha's illness, I was not able to write to you. Before then, I had no idea of her danger. I have lost her, and now learn all too late. She died in the peace of innocence, and in the glorious hope of a blessed futurity. The fiend who betrayed our infatuated hospitality has done it all. I thought I was receiving into my house innocence, gaiety, a charming companion for my lost Bertha. Heavens, what a fool I have been. I thank God my child died without a suspicion of the cause of her sufferings. She is gone without so much as a conjecturing of the nature of her illness, and the accursed passion of the agent of all this misery. I devote my remaining days to tracking and extinguishing a monster. I am told I may hope to accomplish my righteous and merciful purpose. At present, there is scarcely a gleam of light to guide me. I curse my conceited incredulity, my despicable affection of superiority, my blindness, my obstinacy, all too late. I cannot write or talk collectedly now, I am distracted. So soon as I shall have a little recovered, I mean to devote myself for a time to inquiry, which may possibly lead me as far as Vienna. Sometime in the autumn, 2 months hence, or earlier, if I live, I will see you, that is, if you permit me. I will then tell you all that I scarce dare put upon paper now. Farewell. Pray for me, my dear friend. In these terms ended this strange letter. Though I had never seen Bertha Rheinfeldt, my eyes filled with tears at the sudden intelligence. I was startled, as well as profoundly disappointed. The sun had now set, and it was twilight by the time I had returned the general's letter to my father. It was a soft, clear evening, and we loitered, speculating upon the possible meaning of the violent and incoherent sentences which I had just been reading. We had nearly a mile to walk before reaching the road that passes the Schloss in front, and by that time the moon was shining brilliantly. At the drawbridge we met Madame Perrodon and Mademoiselle de la Fontaine, who had come out without their bonnets to enjoy the exquisite moonlight. We heard their voices gabbling in animated dialogue as we approached. We joined them at the drawbridge and turned about to admire with them the beautiful scene. The glade through which we had just walked lay before us. At our left, the narrow road wound away under clumps of lordly trees and was lost to sight amid the thickening forest. At the right, the same road crosses a steep and picturesque bridge, near which stands a ruined tower which once guarded that pass, and beyond the bridge an abrupt eminence arises, covered with trees and showing in the shadows some grey, ivy-clustered rocks. Over the sward and low grounds a thin film of mist was stealing like smoke, marking the distances with a transparent veil, and here and there we could see the river faintly flashing in the moonlight. No softer, sweeter scene could be imagined. The news I had just heard made it melancholy, but nothing could disturb its character of profound serenity and the enchanted glory and vagueness of the prospect. My father, who enjoyed the picturesque, and I stood looking in silence over the expanse beneath us. The two good governesses standing a little way behind us discoursed upon the scene and were eloquent upon the moon. Madame Perrodon was fat, middle-aged, and romantic, and talked and sighed poetically. Mademoiselle de La Fontaine, in right of her father, who was a German, assumed to be psychological, metaphysical, and something of a mystic, now declared that when the moon shone with a light so intense, it was well known that it indicated special spiritual activity. The effect of the full moon in such a state of brilliancy was manifold. It acted on dreams, it acted on lunacy, it acted on nervous people, it had marvellous physical influences connected with life. Mademoiselle related that her cousin, who was a mate of a merchant ship, having taken a nap on deck on such a night, lying on his back with his face full in the light of the moon, had wakened after a dream of an old woman clawing him by the cheek, with his features horribly drawn to one side, and his countenance had never quite recovered its equilibrium. "The moon this night," she said, "is so full of idyllic and magnetic influence, and see, when you look behind you at the front of the Schloss, how all its windows flash and twinkle with that silvery splendour, as if unseen hands had lighted up the rooms to receive fairy guests." There are indolent styles of the spirits, in which, indisposed to talk ourselves, the talk of others is pleasant to our listless ears, and I gazed on, pleased with the tinkle of the lady's conversation. "I have got into one of my moping moods tonight," said my father after a silence, and quoting Shakespeare, whom by way of keeping up our English we used to read aloud, he said, "In truth, I know not why I am so sad. It wearies me. You say it wearies you. But how I got it, came by it, I forget the rest, but I feel as if some great misfortune were hanging over us. I suppose the poor general's afflicted letter has had something to do with it." At this moment, the unwonted sound of carriage wheels and many hoofs upon the road arrested our attention. They seemed to be approaching from the high ground overlooking the bridge, and very soon the equipage emerged from that point. The horsemen first crossed the bridge, and then came a carriage drawn by four horses, and two men rode behind. It seemed to be the travelling carriage of a person of rank, and we were all immediately absorbed in watching that very unusual spectacle. It became, in a few moments, greatly more interesting, for just as the carriage had passed the summit of the steep bridge, one of the leaders, taking fright, communicated his panic to the rest, and after a plunge or two, the whole team broke into a wild gallop together, and dashing between the horsemen who rode in front, came thundering along the road towards us with the speed of a hurricane. The excitement of the scene was made more painful by the clear, long-drawn screams of a female voice from the carriage window. We all advanced in curiosity and horror, me rather in silence, the rest with various ejaculations of terror. Our suspense did not last long. Just before you reach the castle drawbridge on the route they were coming, there stands by the roadside a magnificent lime tree. On the other stands an ancient stone cross, at sight of which the horses, now going at a pace that was perfectly frightful, swerved so as to bring the wheel over the projecting roots of the tree. I knew what was coming. I covered my eyes, unable to see it out, and turned my head away. At the same moment, I heard a cry from my lady friends who had gone on a little. Curiosity opened my eyes, and I saw a scene of utter confusion. Two of the horses were on the ground. The carriage lay upon its side with two wheels in the air. The men were busy removing the traces, and the lady with a commanding air and figure had got out and stood with clasped hands, raising the handkerchief that was in them every now and again to her eyes. Through the carriage door was now lifted a young lady, who appeared to be lifeless. My dear old father was already beside the elder lady with his hat in his hand, evidently tendering his aid and the resources of his schloss. The lady did not appear to hear him, or to have eyes for anything but the slender girl who was being placed against the slope of the bank. I approached. The young lady was apparently stunned, but she was certainly not dead. My father, who piqued himself on being something of a physician, had just had his fingers on her wrist and assured the lady, who declared herself her mother, that her pulse, though faint and irregular, was undoubtedly still distinguishable. The lady clasped her hands and looked upward, as if in a momentary transport of gratitude, but immediately she broke out again in that theatrical way, which is, I believe, natural to some people. She was what is called a fine-looking woman for her time of life, and must have been handsome. She was tall, but not thin, and dressed in black velvet, and looked rather pale, but with a proud and commanding countenance, though now agitated strangely. "Who was ever being so born to calamity?" I heard her say with clasped hands as I came up. "Here am I on a journey of life and death, in prosecuting which to lose an hour is possibly to lose all. My child will not have recovered sufficiently to resume her route for who can say how long. I must leave her. I cannot, dare not delay. How far on, sir, can you tell is the nearest village? I must leave her there, and shall not see my darling, or even hear of her, till my return, 3 months hence." I plucked my father by the coat and whispered earnestly in his ear, "Oh, Papa, pray ask to let her stay with us. It would be so delightful. Do, pray." "If Madame will entrust her child to the care of my daughter and of her good gouvernante, Madame Perdon, and permit her to remain as our guest under my charge until her return, it will confer a distinction and an obligation upon us, and we shall treat her with all the care and devotion which so sacred a trust deserves." "I cannot do that, sir. It would be to task your kindness and chivalry too cruelly," said the lady distractedly. "It would, on the contrary, be to confer on us a very great kindness at a moment when we most need it. My daughter has just been disappointed by a cruel misfortune in a visit for which she had long anticipated a great deal of happiness. If you confide this young lady to our care, it will be her best consolation. The nearest village on your route is distant and affords no such inn as you could think of placing your daughter at. You cannot allow her to continue her journey for any considerable distance without danger. If, as you say, you cannot suspend your journey, you must part with her tonight, and nowhere could you do so with more honest assurance of care and tenderness than here." There was something in this lady's air and appearance so distinguished and even imposing, and in her manner so engaging, as to impress one quite apart from the dignity of her equipage, with the conviction that she was a person of consequence. By this time the carriage was replaced in its upright position, and the horses, quite tractable, in the traces again. The lady threw on her daughter a glance, which I fancied was not quite so affectionate as one might have anticipated from the beginning of the scene. Then she beckoned slightly to my father, and withdrew 2 or 3 steps with him out of hearing, and talked to him with a fixed and stern countenance, not at all like that with which she had hitherto spoken. I was filled with wonder that my father did not seem to perceive the change, and also unspeakably curious to learn what it could be that she was speaking about, almost in his ear, with so much earnestness and rapidity. 2 or 3 minutes at most, I think, she remained thus employed, and then she turned, and a few steps brought her to where her daughter lay, supported by Madame Perdon. She kneeled beside her for a moment and whispered, as Madame supposed, a little benediction in her ear. Then, hastily kissing her, she stepped into her carriage. The door was closed. The footmen in stately liveries jumped up behind. The outriders spurred on. The postillions cracked their whips. The horses plunged and broke suddenly into a furious canter that threatened soon again to become a gallop. And the carriage whirled away, followed at the same rapid pace by the two horsemen in the rear.
Carmilla 3. We compare notes. We followed the cortege with our eyes until it was swiftly lost to sight in the misty wood, and the very sound of the hooves and the wheels died away in the silent night air. Nothing remained to assure us that the adventure had not been an illusion of a moment, but the young lady, who just at that moment opened her eyes. I could not see, for her face was turned from me, but she raised her head, evidently looking about her, and I heard a very sweet voice asking complainingly, "Where is Mama?" Our good Madame Peridon answered tenderly and added some comfortable assurances. I then heard her ask, "Where am I? Where is this place?" And after that she said, "I don't see the carriage, and Matska, where is she?" Madame answered all her questions in so far as she understood them, and gradually the young lady remembered how the misadventure came about, and was glad to hear that no one in or in attendance on the carriage was hurt. And on learning that her mamma had left her there till her return in about 3 months, she wept. I was going to add my consolations to those of Madame Peridon when Mademoiselle de la Fontaine placed her hand upon my arm, saying, "Don't approach, one at a time is as much as she can at present converse with. A very little excitement would possibly overpower her now." As soon as she is comfortably in bed, I thought, I will run up to her room and see her. My father, in the meantime, had sent a servant on horseback for the physician, who lived about 2 leagues away, and a bedroom was being prepared for the young lady's reception. The stranger now rose, and leaning on Madame's arm, walked slowly over the drawbridge and into the castle gate. In the hall, servants waited to receive her, and she was conducted forthwith to her room. The room we usually sat in, as our drawing room, is long, having 4 windows that looked over the moat and the drawbridge upon the forest scene I have just described. It is furnished in old carved oak, with large carved cabinets, and the chairs are cushioned with crimson Utrecht velvet. The walls are covered with tapestry and surrounded with great gold frames, the figures being as large as life, in ancient and very curious costume, and the subjects represented are hunting, hawking, and generally festive. It is not too stately to be extremely comfortable, and here we had our tea, for with his usual patriotic leanings he insisted that the national beverage should make its appearance regularly with our coffee and chocolate. We sat here this night, and with candles lighted were talking over the adventure of the evening. Madame Peridon and Mademoiselle de la Fontaine were both of our party. The young stranger had hardly lain down in her bed when she sank into a deep sleep, and those ladies had left her in the care of a servant. "How do you like our guest?" I asked, as soon as Madame entered. "Tell me all about her." "I like her extremely," answered Madame. "She is, I almost think, the prettiest creature I ever saw, about your age, and so gentle and nice." "She is absolutely beautiful," threw in Mademoiselle, who had peeped for a moment into the stranger's room. "And such a sweet voice," added Madame Peridon. "Did you remark a woman in the carriage after it was set up again who did not get out?" inquired Mademoiselle, "but only looked from the window." "No, we hadn't seen her." "Then she described a hideous black woman with a sort of coloured turban on her head, and who was gazing all the time from the carriage window, nodding and grinning derisively toward the ladies, with gleaming eyes and large white eyeballs, and her teeth set as if in fury." "Did you remark what an ill-looking pack of men those servants were?" asked Madame. "Yes," said my father, who had just come in. "Ugly, hangdog-looking fellows as ever I beheld in my life. I hope they mayn't rob the poor lady in the forest. They're clever rogues, however. They got everything to right in a minute." "I dare say they're wound out with too long travelling," said Madame. "Besides looking wicked, their faces were so strangely lean and dark and sullen. I'm very curious, I own, but I dare say the young lady will tell you all about it tomorrow if she is sufficiently recovered." "I don't think she will," said my father with a mysterious smile and a little nod of his head, as if he knew more about it than he cared to tell us. This made us all the more inquisitive as to what had passed between him and the lady in the black velvet in the brief but earnest interview that had immediately preceded her departure. We were scarcely alone when I entreated him to tell me he didn't need much pressing. "There's no particular reason why I shouldn't tell you." She expressed a reluctance to trouble us with the care of her daughter, saying she was in delicate health and nervous, but not subject to any kind of seizure, she volunteered that, nor to any illusion, being in fact perfectly sane. "How very odd to say all that," I interpolated. "It was so unnecessary." "In all events, it was said," he laughed. "And as you wish to know all that passed, which was indeed very little, I tell you," she then said, "I am making a long journey of vital importance," she emphasized the word, "rapid and secret. I shall return for my child in 3 months. In the meantime, she will be silent as to who we are, whence we come, and whither we are travelling." That's all she said. She spoke very pure French. When she said the word secret, she paused for a few seconds, looking sternly, her eyes fixed on mine. "I fancy she makes a great point of that. You saw how quickly she was gone. I hope I haven't done a very foolish thing in taking charge of the young lady." For my part, I was delighted. I was longing to see and talk to her, and only waiting till the doctor should give me leave. You, who live in towns, can have no idea how great an event the introduction of a new friend is in such a solitude as surrounded us. The doctor didn't arrive till nearly 1 o'clock, but I could no more have gone to my bed and slept than I could have overtaken on foot the carriage in which the princess in black velvet had driven away. When the physician came down to the drawing-room, it was to report very favourably upon his patient. She was now sitting up, her pulse quite regular, apparently perfectly well. She had sustained no injury, and the little shock to her nerves had passed away quite harmlessly. There could be no harm, certainly, in my seeing her, if we both wished it, and, with his permission, I sent forthwith to know whether she would allow me to visit her for a few minutes in her room. The servant returned immediately to say that she desired nothing more. You may be sure I was not long in availing myself of this permission. Our visitor lay in one of the handsomest rooms in the Schloss. It was, perhaps, a little stately. There was a sombre piece of tapestry opposite the foot of the bed, representing Cleopatra with the asps to her bosom, and other solemn classic scenes were displayed, a little faded, upon the other walls. But there was a gold carving and rich and varied colour enough in the other decorations of the room to more than redeem the gloom of the old tapestry. There were candles at the bedside. She was sitting up, her slender, pretty figure enveloped by the soft silk dressing-gown, embroidered with flowers and lined with thick quilted silk, which her mother had thrown over her feet as she lay upon the ground. What was it that, as I reached the bedside and had just begun my little greeting, struck me dumb in a moment and made me recoil a step or two from her? I'll tell you. I saw the very face which had visited me in my childhood at night, which remained so fixed in my memory, and on which I had for so many years so often ruminated with horror when no one suspected of what I was thinking. It was pretty, even beautiful, and when I first beheld it wore the same melancholy expression. But this almost instantly lighted into a strange fixed smile of recognition. There was a silence of fully a minute, and then, at length, she spoke. I could not. "How wonderful!" she exclaimed. 12 years ago I saw your face in a dream, and it has haunted me ever since." "Wonderful indeed," I repeated, overcoming with an effort the horror that had for a time suspended my utterances. 12 years ago, in vision or reality, I certainly saw you. I couldn't forget your face. It's remained before my eyes ever since." Her smile had softened. Whatever I had fancied strange in it was gone, and it and her dimpling cheeks were now delightfully pretty and intelligent. I felt reassured, and continued more in the vein which hospitality indicated, to bid her welcome, and to tell her how much pleasure her accidental arrival had given us all, and especially what a happiness it was to me. I took her hand as I spoke. I was a little shy, as lonely people are, but the situation made me eloquent and even bold. She pressed my hand, she laid hers upon it, and her eyes glowed, as looking hastily into mine she smiled again, and blushed. She answered my welcome very prettily, I sat down beside her, still wondering, and she said, "I must tell you my vision about you. It is so very strange that you and I should have had each of the other so vivid a dream, that each should have seen I you and you me, looking as we do now, when of course we were both mere children. I was a child about 6 years old, and I awoke from a confused and troubled dream and found myself in a room unlike my nursery, wainscoted clumsily in some dark wood and with cupboards and bedsteads and chairs and benches placed about it. The beds were, I thought, all empty in the room itself without anyone but myself in it, and I, after looking about me for some time and admiring especially an iron candlestick with two branches, which I should certainly know again, crept under one of the beds to reach the window, but as I got from under the bed, I heard someone crying and looked up. While I was still upon my knees, I saw you, most assuredly you, as I see you now, a beautiful young lady with golden hair and large blue eyes and lips, your lips, you, as you are here. Your looks won me. I climbed on the bed and put my arms about you, and I think we both fell asleep. I was aroused by a scream. You were sitting up screaming. I was frightened and slipped down upon the ground, and it seemed to me, lost consciousness for a moment, and when I came to myself, I was again in my nursery at home. Your face, I've never forgotten since. I couldn't be misled by mere resemblance. You are the lady whom I saw then. It was now my turn to relate my corresponding vision, which I did, to the undisguised wonder of my new acquaintance. "I don't know which should be most afraid of the other," she said again, smiling. "If you were less pretty, I think I should be very much afraid of you, but being as you are, and you and I both so young, I feel only that I have made your acquaintance 12 years ago, and have already a right to your intimacy. At all events, it does seem as if we were destined from our earliest childhood to be friends. I wonder whether you feel as strangely drawn towards me as I do to you. I have never had a friend. Shall I find one now?" She sighed, and her fine dark eyes gazed passionately on me. "Now, the truth is, I felt rather unaccountably towards the beautiful stranger. I did feel, as she said, drawn towards her. But there was also something of repulsion. In this ambiguous feeling, however, the sense of attraction immensely prevailed. She interested and won me. She was so beautiful and so indescribably engaging. I perceived now something of languor and exhaustion stealing over her, and hastened to bid her good night. "The doctor thinks," I added, "that you ought to have a maid to sit up with you tonight. One of ours is waiting, and you'll find her a very useful and quiet creature." "How kind of you, but I couldn't sleep. I never could with an attendant in the room. I shan't require any assistance, and shall I confess my weakness? I am haunted with the terror of robbers. Our house was robbed once, and two servants murdered, so I always lock my door. It's become a habit, and you look so kind, I know you'll forgive me. I see there's a key in the lock." She held me close in her pretty arms for a moment and whispered in my ear, "Good night, darling. It's very hard to part with you, but good night. Tomorrow, but not early, I shall see you again." She sank back on the pillow with a sigh, and her fine eyes followed me with a fond and melancholy gaze, and she murmured again, "Good night, dear friend." Young people like and even love on impulse. I was flattered by the evident, though as yet undeserved, fondness she showed me. I liked the confidence with which she at once received me. She was determined that we should be very near friends. Next day came, and we met again. I was delighted with my companion, that is to say, in many respects. Her looks lost nothing in daylight. She was certainly the most beautiful creature I had ever seen, and the unpleasant remembrance of the face presented in my early dream had lost the effect of the first unexpected recognition. She confessed that she had experienced a similar shock in seeing me, and precisely the same faint antipathy that had mingled with my admiration of her. We now laugh together over our momentary horrors. Carmilla, 4. Her Habits, a Saunter. I told you that I was charmed with her in most particulars. There were some that didn't please me so well. She was above the middle height of women. I shall begin by describing her. She was slender and wonderfully graceful, except that her movements were languid, very languid indeed. There was nothing in her appearance to indicate an invalid. Her complexion was rich and brilliant. Her features were small and beautifully formed. Her eyes large, dark, and lustrous. Her hair was quite wonderful. I never saw hair so magnificently thick and long when it was down about her shoulders. I have often placed my hands under it and laughed with wonder at its weight. It was exquisitely fine and soft, and in colour a rich, very dark brown with something of gold. I loved to let it down, tumbling with its own weight, as in her room she lay back in her chair, talking in her sweet low voice. I used to fold and braid it and spread it out and play with it. Heavens, if I had but known all. I said there were particulars which did not please me. I've told you that her confidence won me the first night I saw her, but I found that she exercised with respect to herself, her mother, her history, everything in fact connected with her life, plans and people, an ever wakeful reserve. I dare say I was unreasonable, perhaps I was wrong. I dare say I ought to have respected the solemn injunction laid upon my father by this stately lady in black velvet. But curiosity is a restless and unscrupulous passion, and no one girl can endure with patience that hers should be baffled by another. What harm could it do anyone to tell me what I so ardently desired to know? Had she no trust in my good sense or honour? Why would she not believe me when I assured her so solemnly that I wouldn't divulge one syllable of what she told me to any mortal breathing? There was a coldness, it seemed to me, beyond her years, in her smiling, melancholy, persistent refusal to afford me the least ray of light. I can't say we quarrelled upon this point, for she wouldn't quarrel upon any. It was, of course, very unfair of me to press her, very ill-bred, but I really couldn't help it, and I might just as well have left it alone. What she did tell me amounted, in my unconscionable estimation, to nothing. It was all summed up in three very vague disclosures. First, her name was Carmilla. Second, her family was very ancient and noble. Third, her home lay in the direction of the west. She wouldn't tell me the name of her family, nor their armorial bearings, nor the name of their estate, nor even that of the country they lived in. You are not to suppose that I worried her incessantly on these subjects. I watched opportunity and rather insinuated than urged my inquiries. Once or twice, indeed, I did attack her more directly, but no matter what my tactics, utter failure was invariably the result. Reproaches and caresses were all lost upon her, but I must add this, that her evasion was conducted with so pretty a melancholy and deprecation, with so many and even passionate declarations of her liking for me and trust in my honour, and with so many promises that I should at last know all, that I couldn't find it in my heart long to be offended with her. She used to place her pretty arms about my neck, draw me to her, and laying her cheek to mine, murmur with her lips near my ear, "Dearest, your little heart is wounded. Think me not cruel because I obey the irresistible law of my strength and weakness. If your dear heart is wounded, my wild heart bleeds with yours. In the rapture of my enormous humiliation, I live in your warm life, and you shall die, sweetly die, into mine. I can't help it. As I draw near to you, you in your turn will draw near to others and learn the rapture of that cruelty which yet is love. So, for a while, seek to know no more of me and mine, but trust me with all your loving spirit." Her agitations and her language were unintelligible to me. And when she had spoken such a rhapsody, she would press me more closely in her trembling embrace, and her lips in soft kisses gently glow upon my cheek. Her agitations and her language were unintelligible to me. From these foolish embraces, which were not of very frequent occurrence, I must allow, I used to wish to extricate myself, but my energy seemed to fail me. Her murmured words sounded like a lullaby in my ear, and soothed my resistance into a trance, from which I only seemed to recover myself when she withdrew her arms. In these mysterious moods, I didn't like her. I experienced a strange, tumultuous excitement that was pleasurable ever and anon, mingled with a vague sense of fear and disgust. I had no distinct thoughts about her while such scenes lasted, but I was conscious of a love growing into adoration and also of abhorrence. This, I know, is a paradox, but I can make no other attempt to explain the feeling. I now write, after an interval of more than 10 years, with a trembling hand, with a confused and horrible recollection of certain occurrences and situations. In the ordeal through which I was unconsciously passing, though with a vivid and very sharp remembrance of the main current of my story. But, I suspect in all lives there are certain emotional scenes, those in which our passions have been most wildly and terribly roused, that are of all others the most vaguely and dimly remembered. Sometimes, after an hour of apathy, my strange and beautiful companion would take my hand and hold it with a fond pressure, renewed again and again, blushing softly, gazing in my face with languid and burning eyes and breathing so fast that her dress rose and fell with a tumultuous respiration. It was like the ardour of a lover. It embarrassed me. It was hateful and yet overpowering. And with gloating eyes, she drew me to her, and her hot lips travelled along my cheek in kisses, and she would whisper almost in sobs, "You are mine. You shall be mine. You and I are one forever." Then she had thrown herself back in her chair with her small hands over her eyes, leaving me trembling. "Are we related?" I used to ask. "What can you mean by all this? I remind you perhaps of someone whom you love, but you must not. I hate it. I don't know you. I don't know myself when you look so and talk so." She used to sigh at my vehemence, then turn away and drop my hand. Respecting these very extraordinary manifestations, I strove in vain to form any satisfactory theory. I couldn't refer them to affectation or trick. It was unmistakably the momentary breaking out of suppressed instinct and emotion. Was she, notwithstanding her mother's volunteered denial, subject to brief visitations of insanity? Or was there here a disguise and a romance? I had read in old storybooks of such things. What if a boyish lover had found his way into the house and sought to prosecute his suit in masquerade with the assistance of a clever old adventuress? But there were many things against this hypothesis, highly interesting as it was to my vanity. I could boast of no little attentions such as masculine gallantry delights to offer. Between these passionate moments there were long intervals of commonplace, of gaiety, of brooding melancholy, during which, except that I detected her eyes so full of melancholy fire following me, at times I might have been as nothing to her. Except in these brief periods of mysterious excitement, her ways were girlish, and there was always a languor about her, quite incompatible with a masculine system in a state of health. In some respects her habits were odd, perhaps not so singular in the opinion of a town lady like you as they appeared to us rustic people. She used to come down very late, generally not until 1 o'clock. She would then take a cup of chocolate, but eat nothing. We then went out for a walk, which was a mere saunter, and she seemed almost immediately exhausted, and either returned to the Schloss or sat on one of the benches that were placed here and there among the trees. This was a bodily languor in which her mind did not sympathize. She was always an animated talker, and very intelligent. She sometimes alluded for a moment to her own home, or mentioned an adventure or situation, or an early recollection, which indicated a people of strange manners, and described customs of which we knew nothing. I gathered from these chance hints that her native country was much more remote than I had at first fancied. As we sat thus one afternoon under the trees, a funeral passed us by. It was that of a pretty young girl whom I had often seen, the daughter of one of the rangers of the forest. The poor man was walking behind the coffin of his darling. She was his only child, and he looked quite heartbroken. Peasants walking two and two came behind. They were singing a funeral hymn. I rose to mark my respect as they passed and joined in the hymn they were very sweetly singing. My companion shook me a little roughly, and I turned surprised. She said brusquely, "Don't you perceive how discordant that is?" "I think it very sweet, on the contrary," I answered, vexed at her interruption, and very uncomfortable, lest the people who composed the little procession should observe and resent what was passing. I resumed, therefore, instantly, and was again interrupted. "You pierce my ears," said Carmilla almost angrily. and stopping her ears with her tiny fingers. "Besides, how can you tell that your religion and mine are the same? Your forms wound me, and I hate funerals. What a fuss! Why, you must die, everyone must die, and all are happier when they do. Come home." "My father has gone with the clergyman to the churchyard. I thought you knew she was to be buried today." "She? I don't trouble my head about peasants. I don't know who she is," answered Carmilla, with a flash from her fine eyes. "She is the poor girl who fancied she saw a ghost a fortnight ago, and has been dying ever since till yesterday when she expired. Tell me nothing about ghosts. I shan't sleep tonight if you do. I hope there's no plague or fever coming. All this looks very like it," I continued. "The swineherd's young wife died only a week ago, and she thought something seized her by the throat as she lay in bed and nearly strangled her. Papa says such horrible fancies do accompany some forms of fever. She was quite well the day before. She sank afterwards and died before a week. Well, her funeral is over, I hope, and her hymn sung, and our ears shan't be tortured with that discord and jargon. It has made me nervous. Sit down here beside me. Sit close. Hold my hand. Press it hard. Hard. Harder." We had moved a little back, and she had come to another seat. She sat down. Her face underwent a change that alarmed and even terrified me for a moment. It darkened and became horribly livid. Her teeth and hands were clenched, and she frowned and compressed her lips while she stared down upon the ground at her feet and trembled all over with a continued shudder as irrepressible as ague. All her energy seemed strained to suppress a fit with which she was then breathlessly tugging, and at length a low convulsive cry of suffering broke from her, and gradually the hysteria subsided. "There, that comes of strangling people with hymns," she said at last. Hold me still. It's passing away." And so, gradually, it did, and perhaps to dissipate the sombre impression which the spectacle had left upon me, she became unusually animated and chatty, and so we got home. This was the first time I had seen her exhibit any definable symptoms of that delicacy of health which her mother had spoken of. It was the first time also I had seen her exhibit anything like temper. Both passed away like a summer cloud, and never but once afterwards did I witness on her part a momentary sign of anger. I will tell you how it happened. She and I were looking out of one of the long drawing-room windows when there entered the courtyard over the drawbridge a figure of a wanderer whom I knew very well. He used to visit the Schloss generally twice a year. It was the figure of a hunchback with the sharp, lean features that generally accompany deformity. He wore a pointed black beard, and he was smiling from ear to ear, showing his white fangs. He was dressed in buff, black, and scarlet, and crossed with more straps and belts than I could count, from which hung all manner of things. Behind, he carried a magic lantern and two boxes, which I well knew. In one of them was a salamander, and in another a mandrake. These monsters used to make my father laugh. They were compounded of parts of monkeys, parrots, squirrels, fish, and hedgehogs, dried and stitched together with great neatness and startling effect. He had a fiddle, a box of conjuring apparatus, a pair of foils and masks attached to his belt, several other mysterious cases dangling about him, and a black staff with copper ferrules in his hand. His companion was a rough, spare dog that followed at his heels but stopped short, suspiciously, at the drawbridge, and in a little while began to howl dismally. In the meantime, the mountebank standing in the midst of the courtyard raised his grotesque hat and made us a very ceremonious bow, paying his compliments very volubly in execrable French and German not much better. Then, disengaging his fiddle, he began to scrape a lively air to which he sang with a merry discord, dancing with ludicrous airs and activity that made me laugh in spite of the dog's howling. Then he advanced to the window with many smiles and salutations, and his hat in his left hand, his fiddle under his arm, and with a fluency that never took breath, he gabbled a long advertisement of all his accomplishments, and the resources of the various arts which he placed at our service, and the curiosities and entertainments which it was in his power, at our bidding, to display. "Will your ladyships be pleased to buy an amulet against the oupir, which is going like the wolf, I hear, through these woods?" he said, dropping his hat on the pavement. "They are dying of it right and left, and here is a charm that never fails. Only pin to the pillow, and you may laugh in his face. These charms consisted of oblong slips of vellum with cabalistic ciphers and diagrams upon them. Carmilla instantly purchased one, and so did I. He was looking up, and we were smiling down upon him, amused, at least I can answer for myself. His piercing black eye, as he looked up in our faces, seemed to detect something that fixed for a moment his curiosity. In an instant, he unrolled a leather case full of all manner of odd little steel instruments. "See here, my lady," he said, displaying it and addressing me. "I profess, among other things less useful, the art of dentistry." "Plague, take the dog," he interpolated. "Silence, beast! He howls so that your ladyships can scarcely hear a word. Your noble friend, the young lady at your right, has the sharpest tooth. Long, thin, pointed, like an awl, like a needle. With my sharp and long sight as I look up, I've seen it distinctly. Now, if it happens to hurt the young lady, and I think it must, here am I. Here are my file, my punch, my nippers. I will make it round and blunt, if her ladyship pleases. No longer the tooth of a fish, but of a beautiful young lady as she is. Eh? Is the young lady displeased? Have I been too bold? Have I offended her?" The young lady indeed looked very angry as she drew back from the window. "How dares that mountebank insult us so? Where is your father? I shall demand redress from him. My father would have had the wretch tied to the pump and flogged with a cart whip and burnt to the bones with a cattle brand." She retired from the window a step or two and sat down, and had hardly lost sight of the offender when her wrath subsided as suddenly as it had arisen, and she gradually recovered her usual tone and seemed to forget the little hunchback and his follies. My father was out of spirits that evening. On coming in, he told us that there had been another case very similar to the two fatal ones, which had lately occurred. The sister of a young peasant on his estate, only a mile away, was very ill, had been, as she described it, attacked very nearly in the same way, and was now, slowly but steadily, sinking. "All this," said my father, "is strictly referable to natural causes. These poor people infect one another with their superstitions, and so repeat in imagination the images of terror that have infested their neighbours." "But that very circumstance frightens one horribly," said Carmilla. "How so?" inquired my father. "I am so afraid of fancying I see such things, I think it would be as bad as reality." "We are in God's hands, nothing can happen without his permission, and all will end well for those who love him. He is our faithful creator, he has made us all, and will take care of us." "Creator? Nature?" said the young lady in answer to my gentle father. "And this disease that invades the country is natural. Nature? All things proceed from nature, don't they? All things in the heaven, in the earth, and under the earth act and live as nature ordains. I think so." "The doctor said he would come here today," said my father, after a silence. "I want to know what he thinks about it, and what he thinks we had better do." "Doctors never did me any good," said Carmilla. "Then have you been ill?" I asked. "More ill than ever you were," she answered. "Long ago, yes, a long time. I suffered from this very illness, but I forget all but my pain and weakness, and they were not so bad as are suffered in other diseases." "You were very young then, I dare say. Let's talk no more about it. You would not wound a friend." She looked languidly in my eyes and passed her arm around my waist lovingly and led me out of the room. My father was busy over some papers near the window. "Why does your papa like to frighten us?" said the pretty girl with a sigh and a little shudder. "He doesn't, dear Carmilla. It is the very furthest thing from his mind." "Are you afraid, dearest?" "I should be very much if I fancied there was any real danger of me being attacked as those poor people were." "You're afraid to die?" "Yes, everyone is." "But to die as lovers may, to die together so that they may live together. Girls are caterpillars while they live in the world, to be finally butterflies when the summer comes, but in the meantime, there are grubs and larvae, don't you see, each with their peculiar propensities, necessities, and structure. So says Monsieur Buffon in his big book, in the next room." Later in the day, the doctor came and was closeted with Papa for some time. He was a skilful man of 60 and upwards. He wore powder and shaved his pale face as smooth as a pumpkin. He and Papa emerged from the room together, and I heard Papa laugh and say as they came out, "Well, I do wonder at a wise man like you. What do you say to hippogriffs and dragons?" The doctor was smiling and made answer, shaking his head, "Nevertheless, life and death are mysterious states. and we know little of the resources of either. And so they walked on, and I heard no more. I did not then know what the doctor had been broaching, but I think I guess it now. Carmilla, 5. A Wonderful Likeness. This evening there arrived from Graz the grave, dark-faced son of the picture cleaner, with a horse and cart laden with 2 large packing cases, having many pictures in each. It was a journey of 10 leagues, and whenever a messenger arrived at the Schloss from our little capital of Graz, we used to crowd about him in the hall to hear the news. This arrival created in our secluded quarters quite a sensation. The cases remained in the hall, and the messenger was taken charge of by the servants till he had eaten his supper. Then, with assistance and armed with hammer, ripping chisel and turnscrew, he met us in the hall, where we had assembled to witness the unpacking of the cases. Carmilla sat looking listlessly on, while one after the other the old pictures, nearly all portraits, which had undergone the process of renovation were brought to light. My mother was of an old Hungarian family, and most of these pictures, which were about to be restored to their places, had come to us through her. My father had a list in his hand from which he read, as the artist rummaged out the corresponding numbers. I don't know that the pictures were very good, but they were undoubtedly very old, and some of them very curious also. They had, for the most part, the merit of being now seen by me, I may say, for the first time, for the smoke and dust of time had all but obliterated them. "There's a picture that I have not yet seen," said my father. "In one corner at the top of it is the name, as well as I could read, Marcia Karnstein, and the date, 1698, and I'm curious to see how it's turned out." I remembered it. It was a small picture, about 1.5 feet high, and nearly square, without a frame, but it was so blackened by age that I couldn't make it out. The artist now produced it with evident pride. It was quite beautiful. It was startling. It seemed to live. It was the effigy of Carmilla. "Carmilla, dear, here's an absolute miracle. Here you are, living, smiling, ready to speak in this picture. Isn't it beautiful, Papa? And see, even the little mole on her throat." My father laughed and said, "Certainly it's a wonderful likeness." But he looked away, and to my surprise seemed but little struck by it, and went on talking to the picture cleaner, who was also something of an artist, and discoursed with intelligence about the portraits or other works which his art had just brought into light and colour, while I was more and more lost in wonder the more I looked at the picture. "Will you let me hang this picture in my room, Papa?" I asked. "Certainly, dear," said he, smiling. "I'm very glad you think it's so like. It must be prettier even than I thought it, if it is." The young lady didn't acknowledge this pretty speech and didn't seem to hear it. She was leaning back in her seat, her fine eyes under their long lashes gazing on me in contemplation, and she smiled in a kind of rapture. "And now you can read quite plainly the name that is written in the corner. It's not Marcia. It looks as if it was done in gold. The name is Marcella, Countess Karnstein, and this is a little coronet over and underneath, A.D. 1698. I am descended from the Karnsteins, that is, Mama was." "Ah," said the lady languidly, "so am I. I think a very long descent, very ancient. Are there any Karnsteins living now?" "None who bear the name, I believe. The family were ruined, I believe, in some civil wars long ago. But the ruins of the castle are only about 3 miles away." "How interesting," she said languidly. "But see what beautiful moonlight." She glanced through the hall door, which stood a little open. "Suppose you take a little ramble round the court and look down at the road and river." "It's so like the night you came to us," I said. She sighed, smiling. She rose, and each with her arm about the other's waist, we walked out upon the pavement. In silence, slowly we walked down to the drawbridge, where the beautiful landscape opened before us. "And so you were thinking of the night I came here," she almost whispered. "Are you glad I came?" "Delighted, dear Carmilla," I answered. "And you ask for the picture you think like me to hang in your room," she murmured with a sigh, as she drew her arm closer about my waist and let her pretty head sink upon my shoulder. "How romantic you are, Carmilla," I said. "Whenever you tell me a story, it will be made up chiefly of some great romance." She kissed me silently. "I'm sure, Carmilla, that you have been in love, that there is at this moment an affair of the heart going on." "I have been in love with no one. And never shall," she whispered, "unless it should be with you." How beautiful she looked in the moonlight. Shy and strange was the look with which she quickly hid her face in my neck and hair, with tumultuous sighs that seemed almost a sob, and pressed in mine a hand that trembled. Her soft cheek was glowing against mine. "Darling, darling," she murmured, "I live in you, and you would die for me. I love you so." I started from her. She was gazing on me with eyes from which all fire, all meaning had flown, and a face colourless and apathetic. "Is there a chill in the air, dear?" she said drowsily. "I almost shiver. Have I been dreaming? Let us come in. Come, come in." "You look ill, Carmilla, a little faint. You certainly must take some wine," I said. "Yes, I will. I'm better now. I shall be quite well in a few minutes." "Yes, do give me a little wine," answered Carmilla as we approached the door. "Let us look again for a moment. It's the last time, perhaps, I shall see the moonlight with you. How do you feel now, dear Carmilla? Are you really better?" I asked. I was beginning to take alarm lest she should have been stricken with the strange epidemic that they say had invaded the country about us. "Papa would be grieved beyond measure," I added, "if he thought you were ever so little ill without immediately letting us know. We have a very skilful doctor near us, the physician who was with Papa today." "I'm sure he is. I know how kind you all are, but, dear child, I'm quite well again. There's nothing ever wrong with me but a little weakness. People say I'm languid, I am incapable of exertion, I can scarcely walk as far as a child of 3 years old, and every now and then the little strength I have falters, and I become as you've just seen me. But after all, I'm very easily set up again. In a moment, I'm perfectly myself. See how I've recovered." So indeed she had, and she and I talked a great deal, and very animated she was, and the remainder of that evening passed without any recurrence of what I called her infatuations. I mean her crazy talk and looks, which embarrassed and even frightened me. But there occurred that night an event which gave my thoughts quite a new turn, and seemed to startle even Carmilla's languid nature into momentary energy. So that was the first part of Carmilla by Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu. And that was up to chapter 5, and we're going to be doing, I think, the 16th chapter, so it might actually take up 3 episodes. I'm not going to say much about it now. I've put some notes up about Sheridan Le Fanu, who was an Irish guy born in Dublin of Huguenot, French Huguenot descent, hence the name Le Fanu. So I'm not going to say much about him. You can read it on the notes. I've also formulated, I don't know if that's a word, produced a version of a PDF version, an EPUB and a Kindle version, which I've put a link to in the show notes, okay? So you'll be able to get those for nothing, for free. They're on my Patreon page. Aha, you see, that's my clever plan. You don't have to pay anything to get them, of course, and there's a few things up there, and there'll be more stuff you can get without anything, without any commitment from yourself. But if you do want to support me, then that I would absolutely wonderfully love it. I've got 2 patrons now, which is good. The podcast is going really well. We've had, well, by the time you hear this, it'll probably be about 4,000 listens, which is really amazing, and I think better than I thought it would be, really. So that's really good, and it's encouraged me to keep on going. Had some reviews. We had a 5-star by Mike. We had I can't remember the lady's name, which is appalling of me, on Stitcher, was another 5-star, which was very gratefully received. Then some, not that I'm bitter, but some anonymous person didn't put a comment, just 1-starred it. And I'm thinking, wow, that seems a bit harsh. And even if they'd said, we're going to 1-star this because we don't like your choice of stories, don't like the way you read, don't like your voice, don't like your American accent. Only half did it then. Don't like your English accent. Don't like your whatever. Don't like your name. Don't like the way you look at me. Then I would have been able to do something about that. Even I would have looked at them different if I found out who they were. So anyway, that's it. Not that I'm brooding about it. But yeah, crack on. So the next week will be Carmilla. More Carmilla. Plenty of Carmilla. I actually really like it. It's one of my favourite vampire stories. Dracula's my favourite, Carmilla's second. And I just love the setting deep in that Corinthian wood in the middle of remote Austria With the moonlight coming down on this ancient castle. It's very Gothic. Makes me want to dress up and wander around with a monocle and top hat. And how do you know I don't? Anyway, so been lovely monologuing. Can't really call this a conversation. I got interviewed, actually, for another podcast about this podcast. So that was nice. I may get guests on this, but I think it would dilute it. Really, it just is about the story, I think. Anyway, you all take care, all of you, all 5,000 of you listening. So it's not 5,000 people, but there's some maths. There'll be some algorithm to work out somewhere. Anyway, Halloween tomorrow, and I'm alone on my own because Sheila, my partner, is doing a tea and tarot thing. She's a psychic medium, and so if you wanted a psychic reading, we can do that. We can do it all. Anyway, I'm rambling now. Bye.